I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and here's where we are, or rather, where they are. John McCain returned to New Hampshire today. Barack Obama is in Virginia. Here's where they are statistically. A new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll gives Obama a double-digit national lead, with Democrat gaining ground among independents and suburban voters who say they're more comfortable with the candidate than they were previously. The poll also shows voters are less comfortable with Sarah Palin. More voters, 55%, now think Sarah Palin is not qualified to be president. That's up 5% from 2 weeks ago. Well, with less than 2 weeks to go before Election Day, there's a lot of things percolating. What was Joe Biden talking about the other day? So we turn now to Rick Klein, ABC News senior political reporter and author of The Note at ABC.com. And Rick, start with McCain. He's obviously playing defense. What's he trying to do to turn things around?
You know, it's a map that is just getting worse almost by the day for John McCain. He's trying to push a message right now, and it's really twofold. One has to do with national security and having the experience to deal with international crises, and that's where he keys off of a comment that Joe Biden made the other day about Obama being tested early in his time in office. The other message that he's pushing right now is about taxes and the economy. He's highlighting Joe the plumber everywhere he goes. We understand he'll appear with him today in Ohio with Joe the plumber, and try to make the case that John McCain's tax plan and Barack Obama's tax plan are much different in their approaches, and that under Barack Obama's tax plan, you're much more likely to face a tax increase.
Well, let's take those one at a time. The Joe Biden comment. This was in Seattle. Here's some of the quote. He said, "It will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama as they did John Kennedy." He said, "We're going to have an international crisis, a generated crisis, to test the mettle of this guy." Now, Biden is chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're reminded on the day before 9/11, years ago, he warned of danger coming to the U.S. in the belly of a plane. So what are people making of his comment now, you know, warning about an attack to test Barack Obama if Barack Obama and Joe Biden win? You know, are people wondering if Biden knows something?
Well, it depends on your perspective. I think if you're a fan of Joe Biden and the Democratic ticket, you say, well, this what he's describing here is a statement of fact that almost certainly there will be someone in the world who tries to test this young, inexperienced president.
And well, but isn't that sort of a reason for someone not to vote for him?
That's the other side of it, yeah. I mean, if you read that as a statement of fact and say, well, now he's making the best argument that John McCain has. That's certainly the way that the McCain campaign is pitching it. Now, Barack Obama says because he's going to be tested, that because there will be testing of a new president, that is why you need someone like Barack Obama and be with him. He has also indicated these were comments made at a fundraiser behind closed doors. He didn't realize a reporter was present. I don't think he would have been quite this frank. But another example of Joe Biden's mouth getting him in trouble. The Republicans just jumping all over this.
Well, and that John McCain saying he, McCain, already has been tested. And Barack Obama's campaigning in Virginia today on foreign policy, presumably to maybe counter some of these concerns. But we're wondering, why hasn't Biden come out and clarified what he meant?
I think they don't want to make it any worse. They don't want to do anything that's going to upset things. They want to just ride it out. As long as they're up double digits nationally, up in the critical states, I've seen two polls recently that have him up 10 points in Virginia. If he wins Virginia, good night and good luck. It really is going to be the election. So they don't want to do anything that creates a storyline. And so I think they want this to go away. And that's my guess as to why he's not addressing it.
Well, Sarah Palin is under fire. She had to apologize for saying that Republican parts of the country are more American and more patriotic. An Associated Press investigation found she billed the state of Alaska $21,000 for her daughter's airfare. And then Politico.com revealed that the Republican Party spent more than $150,000 on her clothing at high-priced stores. But she and McCain continue to hammer Obama with the Joe the Plumber story. They've released an ad with American workers saying that they're Joe the Plumber and they don't want to be taxed more. And here's Palin in Ohio on taxes this morning.
And Barack Obama calls this spreading the wealth. And Joe Biden called it higher taxes patriotic. But from right here in Ohio, Joe the Plumber said to him, it sounded like socialism.
Rick Klein, there's that word socialism, which has been out on the campaign trail quite a bit. We're going to talk more about that. But is Obama's tax plan socialist, and is this going to work for the Republicans?
It's not socialist. You know, it builds on an American tradition of progressive taxation that you see elsewhere in the world as well. But I think the key point from Obama's perspective, and he's not shy about it, he'll go and tell Joe the Plumber or anyone else, is if you're rich, we do want you to have to pay more. We think it's right for you to pay more. It's a different theory of taxation. As to whether it works, you know, the idea of attacking a tax and spend liberal on the road to socialism, it has been a Trump card for for Republicans to use against Democrats for generations. The question is whether it's just grown old, and the crises that people feel right now in their pocketbooks and the anxiety over world affairs, whether any of this messaging like that, whether that gets through in an environment like this, is very, very difficult.
Well, even Mitt Romney has said Obama's plan isn't socialism. We know that in European countries where there are high taxes, in return you get, for instance, free health care. But we're hearing that, you know, the use of words by the Republicans has had a negative impact. Some polls are showing that Sarah Palin's loss in the polls is a direct result of Colin Powell's comments on Sunday admonishing the Republican Party for tossing around the word Muslim. How are you hearing people use these words?
I think, you know, similar to the way that Sarah Palin used the word socialist, you want this to linger out there. And if you're running against Barack Obama, you wouldn't mind the perception out there that he's socialist or the perception really that he's Muslim. You don't have to say it directly. And in fact, when pressed on it yesterday on CNN, Sarah Palin said, no, I wouldn't use the word socialist to describe him. But you keep that name, that word in the mix, and let it fester, let it linger out there. We've seen lots of folks at McCain and Palin rallies saying these things and believing these things. You know, I've been asked by folks at radio hosts around the country who come out and say, you know, why isn't the media saying that he's a Muslim socialist already? And, you know, these are the perceptions that are out there, for better or for worse, and I think mostly for worse because they're inaccurate. The McCain and Palin campaigns, although, you know, not directly saying, have let these perceptions linger to some degree, to a degree that helps them politically.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of The Node at ABC.com. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, some critics are also calling the financial bailout socialist. Is it? We thought we'd call up a socialist. Mike Davis is author of In Praise of Barbarians, Essays Against Empire. He's also written a recent essay on whether any president can initiate a new deal as FDR did in the 30s. But we want to start with a financial crisis. Mike Davis, self-described aging socialist, welcome.
Thank you.
You write, you never believed you'd actually live to see financial capitalism commit suicide, as you feel it has in the last couple of weeks.
No, I compared myself to the Jehovah's Witness who opens up his window one morning to see stars actually falling out of the sky.
And do you really think, though, that you're seeing the end of the world of capitalism? I mean, Americans who may be rejoicing at the fall of a Wall Street CEO may still reserve the right to want to be one. It's the American way to want unfettered growth. So do you think that spirit is dead?
Oh, of course not. What's being denounced as socialism or described as nationalization of the financial system is in many ways the opposite. We're creating immense public subsidies to speed up the further centralization and concentration of power and a handful of super banks. It's a kind of alter capitalism, not socialism.
So you're actually seeing a growth in capitalism, but Sarah Palin and others are shouting socialism. So are you seeing even a small rise in socialism?
Well, I mean, this country has such absurd coordinates for defining, you know, left and right, to the point that it's become conventional, particularly on the Rush Limbaugh circles, to take people who have roughly the domestic and foreign policies of Richard Nixon, like, for instance, Hillary Clinton, and describe them as the left or the far left. And this is only possible because what had been the stable coordinate, defining coordinate in American politics, New Deal liberalism, has really ceased to exist except in a kind of rhetorical, ghostly rhetorical life amongst Democratic candidates. But any real commitment to full employment, to the provision of an economic bill of rights, such as FDR ran on in his fourth term election, has become, you know, all but extinct. American liberalism defined itself as an economic bill of rights, assuring to Americans more or less the same rights that most Europeans now have. Socialists differed from that in their belief that the full guarantee of those rights and the real exercise of democracy in this country ultimately depends on social ownership of the Fortune 500. And now we're in a situation with a bailout where the government has just invested $125 billion to recapitalize the banks. And the government itself hasn't taken a position of voting shares. It has, you know, preferred shares and doesn't vote. So this is about as far from socialism as I could imagine.
The government is investing in banks, infusing them with money, but not giving Americans ownership of those companies. Nobody's going to sit on any board anytime soon.
or anything like what's been achieved in some of the largest concentrations of investment capital in America, namely pension funds. You know, pension funds do have criteria for investment. They do have a politics. And it seems to me that if we're going to recapitalize the financial system, with that should come, you know, proportionate control, particularly when it's a matter of deciding whether we're going to export or destroy, you know, American jobs for the sake of short-term profit. That control could become an important lever. But it's amazing that you know, they've gotten away with not just the bailout, but a bailout without, you know, any kind of real or decisive oversight, a point that's been made by conservatives and libertarians, probably even more often than by progressive Democrats.
Well, so there you stand on, you know, whether or not what's happening in the financial crisis is socialism, as it's being called. But you also write that the fear that's sort of free-floating between the financial situation and the anxiety about the upcoming election has already been distilled into the same myths that rallied the Germans to the swastika. That's a pretty big charge. And you're talking about AM radio and how it sort of distilled the current stories down to a couple of quick lines. Let me just tick through what you feel you're hearing on AM radio. Barack Obama is a terrorist. The collapse of Wall Street was caused by elderly black people with Fannie Mae loans. And Acorn, in its voter registration drives, is padding the voting rolls with illegal brown hordes.
Well, I mean, first of all, I stand in the shoes of Sinclair Lewis, whose warning about star-spangled fascism, it can happen here, is still the exemplary course.
Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here, written in the 30s, set, I think, in Vermont, showing through fiction how fascism could come to America through the demonizing of others.
Well, and not just by demagoguery, but by an economic suffering and sudden loss of social mobility, which then became focused on the figure of another. And the problem is, in this country right now, we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, the Bush administration totally sideswiped by an uprising in the ranks against immigrant labor. This furnishes an all-too-convenient one-stop explanation for all of our problems. It's continually inflamed by a host of hate radio DJs who dominate commute time. Where I am in San Diego, we have a defrocked former mayor, Roger Hedgecock, dominates commute time radio here, constantly blaming everything on, you know, brown hordes from across the border.
I should jump in to say, in some cities, you find it on the FM dial. We've heard FM hosts refer to people in foreclosures as, parents, please forgive this phrase, bastard factories.
What we once dismissed, for instance, in the form of a few Minutemen on the Arizona border, has become a major political movement, and it's not hard to see that in conditions of a depressed economy, with people out of work, losing their businesses and mortgages, this could grow into, you know, a fairly frightening political force.
That's socialist Mike Davis, author of In Praise of Barbarians, Essays Against Empire. His article, Can Obama See the Grand Canyon, appears on the website tomdispatch.com. Now, you can read it by going to our website, here-now.org. It's about the possibility of a new deal, and you can hear us talk about it in just 1 minute. We're going to be back with that. And later, all the tax questions on the ballot this November 4th across the country. Back in a minute. Here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with author and self-described aging socialist Mike Davis about what is and isn't socialism, as that term is bandied about on the campaign trail. Now, Mike says socialism is when taxpayers or government gets ownership of industry, or as in Sweden, taxpayers pay high taxes but get public health care. Critics called the New Deal of the 1930s socialism. These were the government reforms, regulations, and work programs that then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt put in place to lift the country out of the Great Depression. And now there's a call for a new deal, especially on the part of Barack Obama backers. In a recent essay, Mike Davis said, don't count on it, even if Obama is elected. So, Mike, make your case. Why is a new deal a non-starter?
The argument I was really making is that the Depression of the 30s is not a complete and in many ways an inadequate analog to what's happening today. And the New Deal is not perhaps the best template to understand an alternative because, you know, in the first place, the New Deal didn't arise out of the nobility or the visionary imagination of the White House. It arose in a situation of the greatest social movement in American history, the uprising of industrial labor in the 1930s, which transformed political debate and made it possible for all kinds of newfangled ideas about state intervention, demand management, the responsibility of the government for employment to take root as actual policy. And the problem today is the American labor movement, if anything, is more progressive and has better programs than did the American Federation of Labor in 1933. But it doesn't have the kind of same social power or structural strength. I mean, look, in 1933, 40% of the factories in America were closed, but we hadn't yet sold off the machines and the means of production to China at 5 cents on the dollar. As we have now.
Well, you go on to argue that Obama won't have the brain trust that Roosevelt had, the advice and guidance of people like economist John Maynard Keynes, the father of the idea that government intervention smooths out the economy. But Obama will have, presumably, Paul Krugman, who just won the Nobel, who just wrote very eloquently about what happened during the New Deal. I mean, there are people around who could speak to that.
Well, I have the greatest respect for Krugman or Kuttner, but you have to remember this is kind of unrequited love. They support Obama, but by all accounts, Obama sits at the knee of Paul Volcker, the former head of the Federal Reserve, who plunged the U.S. into its deepest post-war industrial recession at the end of the Carter period, the beginning of the Reagan period, in order to expunge inflation and raise the profits of the financial sector. Obama said during the presidential debate that, you know, he took his economic wisdom from two people, from, you know, Volcker and Warren Buffett. So I think liberals and progressives have to be very wary of thinking that people like Krugman are going to have any deep influence in this administration.
You write, another problem with the New Deal analogy is military spending. America's entry into the Second World War and the industrial production that followed is credited with helping to lift the country out of depression. And the U.S. is now involved in two wars. But you say that military spending can no longer be counted on to spur the economy. Remind us why.
The problem is today we already have, you know, an enormous military budget, maybe not as big proportionally as before. But the impact on jobs and the real economy is much smaller. Military spending doesn't create automatically tens of thousands of jobs in shipyards or aircraft factories or, you know, translate into an economic stimulus. On contrary, the enormous crisis that will beset an Obama administration early in its first 6 months is that the demands of increasing war in the Middle East, which could become a conflagration from the Mediterranean to the Indus, will end up destroying hopes of implementing the social goals of green energy or healthcare reform or kind of adequate response to the jobs crisis. In other words, domestic spending and military spending, which were united in a single model during the years of the high Cold War, now compete for each other.
Guns and butter.
Yes, and guns and butter are now a choice, not a complement to each other.
Well, the last argument that we have time for anyway for a new deal is that the mechanisms are already in place. You know, a lot of the systems and agencies were set up because of FDR. But you write that, you know, you're cynical that any president can do this. Because you lived through the Lyndon Johnson years. Why is that relevant?
Lyndon Johnson's, you know, greatest love was the war on poverty. This was his continuation of the fight for the New Deal. This is him completing the work. If the Civil Rights Bill was him completing the work of Lincoln, this was him completing the work of FDR. And he sacrificed that. He saw the war on poverty dismantled, you know, piece by piece. As the war escalated in Vietnam and the costs soared, country went into inflation, the dollar became weak, and he ended up sacrificing his most important social program, his chief legacy, to the cost of foreign intervention. You have to ask the same question of President Obama. What will be his, you know, highest priority? You know, is it expanding the war in Afghanistan, or, you know, is it to keep his eyes on the real prize, which is expanding domestic demand, saving jobs, fighting for a human safety net in this country, which has been so badly served by public policy for the last generation.
Mike Davis, author of In Praise of Barbarians, Essays Against Empire, and also of an article, Can Obama See the Grand Canyon? It appears on the website tomdispatch.com. And by the way, just explain the Grand Canyon part.
Well, the Grand Canyon, simply because the first explorers who looked into its abyss couldn't actually see it because there was no real landscape analog in European experience for the geology of the Grand Canyon. So the question I'm asking is whether we're not looking into a similar abyss today, a future of economic and social turmoil in which past analogs, including the Depression and the New Deal, are poor guides. And so the question is, how do you, you know, begin to see in a landscape that is so unprecedented and in many ways is equally horrifying as the Grand Canyon was to the conquistadors?
Mike Davis, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have a conversation about mixed-race Americans, even as some Americans say the Bible tells them it's unholy. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, how a state treasurer here in Massachusetts is sweating out the financial crisis here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. While the country's eyes and ears are on the presidential race, there's another battle taking shape at the ballot box. There are more than 100 tax measures making their way onto state ballots this year, most of them looking to cut taxes in some way. Among the most watched, the proposal to abolish personal income tax here in Massachusetts, which proponents hope will inspire a new national tax-cutting movement. This, as state and local governments already face flattening tax revenues and concern about rising costs because of the Wall Street crisis. Well, there are a few ballot initiatives to increase revenues. Arkansas is considering a lottery. Missouri wants to raise the tax on casinos. Minnesota wants to increase its sales tax to protect natural resources and fund arts programs. And there may be another silver lining for states and cities, and that's investor interest in municipal bonds. We'll talk to a state treasurer about that in a moment. But first, Tom Herman, senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal and author of the Journal's weekly tax column. And Tom, give us the overall picture. Most of the ballot questions are understandably about cutting taxes, as we just said, but there are a lot of them. Are most of them serious?
It's hard to tell yet, Robin. Polls are bad enough at the presidential and congressional levels, but polling is really bad on ballot issues. We also don't yet know for sure exactly how many of these issues will make it onto ballots. Some still have not yet received final approval from state officials or they may run into court challenges. But we do know that at least there are dozens of proposals. Some of them come from citizen initiatives and some come from state legislatures, and a few are being taken very seriously, especially in Massachusetts.
Well, let's start there. And the ballot question there does come from a citizen's initiative. Tell us about ballot one.
That's right. This is probably the most talked about in the country. In Massachusetts, the question is whether to eliminate the state income tax. The proposal would be to do it in two shots over 2 years, but it would take it down to zero. It's now 5.3%, so it would be cut in half next year and then disappear entirely the next year. And it wouldn't be replaced by anything. There's nothing on the ballot to say we'd increase some other tax to make up the revenue. So the people who want this are hoping very much that voters are going to vote for it because they're very upset by tough economic times and government spending. Also, 6 years ago, a similar proposal attracted 45% of the vote. So Massachusetts officials are taking this one very seriously.
Well, it was defeated then, but the people backing it now say that it could put $4,000 back in the pockets of 3.4 million workers and taxpayers in Massachusetts. And as you said, there's a lot of anger about government spending. There's also a lot of fear about what may be down the road. But the state, Massachusetts, just announced a cut of 1,000 jobs, and they're going to slash $1 billion from the budget. And I'm just wondering your sense or analysts' sense, if people start to feel cuts and an economic pinch, is that going to make them more likely to vote for erasing the income tax because they're worried about their own pocketbook? Or is it going to make them less likely because they understand that these taxes go to pay for programs that they may depend on?
Great question, Robin, but it's just too soon to tell. People all over the country are watching the Massachusetts vote very closely. Grover Norquist, who runs a group called Americans for Tax Reform, says that if it passes in Massachusetts, it could be a model for many other states. So that's why it's attracting a lot of attention.
Let's take a look at Oregon. What is the question there?
The Oregon question is very important, and it also may be a model for other states. Under current law, very few states allow their taxpayers to deduct their federal income taxes on the state return. Oregon already does that, but there are limits on how much can be deducted. In this November's election, voters are going to decide whether to remove those limits. That would mean taxpayers there could deduct all of their federal income taxes on their state tax returns. Mm-hmm. That would be a major change. Now, the governor there, who's a Democrat, is strongly opposed to this idea. And critics also say that if this thing gets approved, it wouldn't benefit most Oregonians, and it could blow a big hole in the Oregon state budget.
They'd get a lot less revenue if people were deducting their federal tax.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Colorado has a couple of considerations. I want to go first with an amendment that would gut Colorado's taxpayer bill of rights. It was said to be the strongest taxpayer protection in the country. They're considering this. Tell us more about how they may be considering redesigning the taxpayer bills there.
There are actually two issues in Colorado. One is whether to make major changes to what they call their taxpayer bill of rights law, and that's the issue that you just raised there. It's a complicated one, but it would basically limit the annual growth of state tax revenue to inflation plus population increases. And that would also require money that the state gets above that formula be sent back to taxpayers. But the question is whether they're going to gut that. There is a separate one, though, and that would increase the state sales tax. It would raise the state sales tax by 0.2%. And that would be specifically designed for services for programs aimed at the developmentally disabled.
And that gets us into the categories of the states that have proposals for raising some taxes. But what is the thinking in Colorado? Because I'm wondering if other states are watching that as well. Is the thinking that, especially in these economic times, people are going to vote for a sales tax increase, even if it's for such a good purpose, helping people with disabilities?
Well, there are other proposals like that. That's true. But my guess is that states are going to try and muddle through with other tax increases and not sales tax increases. The easier ways to do it would be to raise taxes on beer, wine, and soda, or on gambling. And also just borrowing the money. That's the other thing, is just have bond issues instead of taxing. Those are the ways generally that states have been trying to muddle through. The big question now, though, is with state taxes weakening so significantly recently, will that be enough? And that's unclear. I just got a report very recently headlined, "The Damage is Just Beginning." They say developments since June alone suggest a substantial weakening in state and local tax revenue.
But is there one light at the end of the fiscal crisis tunnel for states and cities? Because you wrote an article, "Is it time to load up on munis?" These are municipal bonds. It's kind of an investment you make in your city or state. Some people were suggesting that. What's the thinking on that?
There's a lot of concern about state and local government bonds, but many investment advisors I've talked to think this could be a good time to load up on them. There are two general reasons. One is a lot of people think that taxes may go up next year no matter who's elected, and therefore the best thing to do would be to buy tax-exempt bonds issued by state and local governments. The other is that there's a lot of concern now about those state and local governments. Therefore, yields are unusually high compared to other securities. They are not, absolutely not, guaranteed by the federal government, but there's been a very low default rate over time, so the investment advisors I've talked to say consider high-quality bonds issued by major state governments.
In other words, try to find a city that's not sort of teetering.
A city or a state, or if you want even more diversification, you can buy a mutual fund that invests in bonds across the country.
It's kind of a civic thing to do, too. There's a significant question that didn't make it to the ballot. That's in Nevada, where there was a proposed amendment to the Constitution that would have imposed a new cap on property tax increases. And tell us a little bit about the tension between falling home prices and rising property taxes. I mean, a lot of voters are angry about that.
They sure are, and that's what led to Proposition 13 in California back in 1978. Voters were really scared there about being priced out of their homes by surging property taxes. So that's why there was a lot of upset in Nevada over this. I spoke to a former state legislator out there, Sharon Engel, who heads a group that was trying to get that proposal on the ballot. She said many voters have complained that property taxes are going up even though home values have dropped.
Wall Street Journal tax reporter Tom Herman. Tom, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
By the way, what do you think about taxes or anything on the program? Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. And you are listening to Here and Now. And we just heard about the Massachusetts ballot referendum on eliminating the state's 5.3% income tax. Anti-tax people say eliminating the income tax would save taxpayers an average nearly $4,000 apiece. Opponents argue that ending the income tax would slash the state budget by nearly 40%, as the state is facing a $1.4 billion budget shortfall that last week led to a cut of more than 1,000 jobs after the Wall Street collapse. Well, Massachusetts State Treasurer Timothy Cahill joins us. Now, first, just a quick touch on the ballot question. You and the governor are obviously against it, but polls show it's close. So our question to you, if it passes and becomes law, will the legislature dare overturn it, given that people are so angry?
I don't see there's any way that the legislature would not have to come back into session and at least try to amend it, if not totally overturn it, because I don't believe there is physically a way for us to cut that much out of the budget without transferring those costs somewhere else. So for people who think they're going to get a tax saving, they may end up paying it just out of another pocket.
Well, the voters are going to decide on this issue on November 4th, but we thought you'd give us some insight into just what states are going through. For instance, earlier this month, you made national news when Massachusetts, with pristine credit records, tried to sell $750 million in these short-term notes that are regular IOUs that businesses take out to pay day-to-day operating costs, in this case, state costs. A fairly common sale, but you had a hard time. What does this say to you about what's going on?
It just says that the markets are upside down, that credit has dried up. We were fortunate to actually get those notes sold at a pretty reasonable price because the window opened for us slightly. And because we have such good credit, it really helped us withstand some of the just insanity that's out there on Wall Street right now. I was just saying recently, this Monday this week was the first Monday in about 5 weeks that we haven't had a crisis here in the Treasurer's office, and it's been rather calm so far.
Are you seeing credit thaw?
A little bit. California was just out in the market last week. They sold billions of dollars worth of short-term notes, purchased primarily by small retail investors, mom-and-pop investors. So that's really the way to go for states is sell these notes to small-time investors as opposed to the big-time investors.
And there you are, encouraging people to buy, you know, bonds in their cities
and
states.
Like the old war days.
Yeah, but, you know, people are nervous because they're being told, well, you've got to be careful even with states and cities. And yeah, how can you assure someone that states and cities, maybe not Massachusetts, but others, aren't going to collapse?
That's a tough call, especially when you look at a California, which is looking at a $15 billion deficit. I can speak pretty strongly about Massachusetts' strength, and I think what the governor did last week was step up to the plate to address the shortfall. That's what we all need to do. We cannot spend beyond our means. We can't try to borrow our way out of this.
Well, with that in mind, I just want to ask you briefly about a very dramatic story that was outlined in the Boston Globe of the day that you and your staff were watching the stock of one of the biggest banks in Massachusetts, Sovereign Bank, and the stocks were plummeting. And you made a decision to pull $300 million of the state funds out of that bank. Now, Sovereign Bank was bought by a Spanish bank that week. What was that like to make that decision to pull money out knowing what you were going to do to a bank?
It was a tough decision. I mean, I didn't wrestle with it because it was the right thing to do in regards of safeguarding the taxpayers' money. We had tried previously to get the money that we had with Sovereign collateralized so that there would be something to back the money if the bank was to go under. And we hadn't had time to do that. So we felt that the safest way to go was to take our money out. We've since brought it back to Sovereign, and it's fully collateralized now.
It's not Sovereign anymore.
We feel comfortable with the bank as it is right now. This bank, actually, the Spanish bank, is, I think, a stronger entity than Sovereign was. But it was a sad day in a sense because Sovereign was not going bankrupt. They had not mismanaged the situation. There was just a real run on the stock that day.
And do you think it contributed to that with the state pulling out $300 million?
We didn't because nobody knew we were doing it, and the stock eventually recovered. But it's a tough decision that we had to make to put the state's interest ahead of the bank's interest.
It seems as if state treasurers everywhere are playing whack-a-mole, you know, just moving things around, you know, trying to keep money, state money safe.
Yeah, I mean, there's a story today about a business that's getting tied up. Their stock was getting tied up because they loaned their stock to Lehman Brothers, and now it's tied up in the bankruptcy. And we can't afford to have that happen to a state because this isn't private money. This isn't someone's investment. This is taxpayer money.
Massachusetts State Treasurer Tim Cahill, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, coming up, music from Girl Talk. Or is it really? That's in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Now it's time for me to get on the mic and make this tag team party hype. I'm taking it back to the old school because I'm a old fool who's so cool. If you want to get down, I'm going to show you the way.
Welcome back. You might recognize what's going on here. Those drums and that guitar are from the Scottish new wave band Big Country. The vocals are tag team's Woomp, There It Is. And there's also a little bit of Kraftwerk, that electronic group formed in the 70s. The clip is Hands in the Air from the album Feed the Animals, which is scheduled for release next month but already available online. It's from Pittsburgh-based producer Greg Gillis, who forges his music from other people's music. He performs as Girl Talk, pulling apart, cutting up, and weaving together a sort of meta-pop. It's catchy, it's danceable. But since no permission was obtained for these samples, is it also illegal? The New York Times says Feed the Animals is a lawsuit waiting to happen. Now, no lawsuits have been filed against Greg, but copyright law has a loophole called fair use. And when we spoke to Greg recently, we asked him, does he think that loophole gives him permission?
Yeah, and I mean, the way I look at it, I don't really even see it as a loophole, just, you know, a component of it. With any sort of music, you can't really make it without influence, so you have to take something that previously exists, an idea, manipulate it, change it, put it into a new context.
So you're saying you think all songwriters are sort of, in a way, borrowing other notes, borrowing other ideas?
Sure. I mean, I think, the history is very traceable through blues, on through Rolling Stones and things like that, and a lot of people admit to taking chord progressions, ideas, songs, putting your own twist on it, and if you do a good enough job at recontextualizing it, it is considered original.
Well, and in your case, just to be clear, mm-hmm. Because some people interpret the fair use laws as saying you can comment on someone else's work. For instance, if you mm-hmm. sample a little bit of Joni Mitchell and then go on and do your own song, that's one thing. But are any of the notes, any of the music that is in your songs, is any of it original from you?
My last album, Night Ripper, the one from 2006, there's a few tracks with, original instrumentation as far as, like, keyboard or synthesizer work. On the new one, though, as far as, original instrumentation versus sampling others' work, the entire album is made from sampling other people's work.
That's sort of like, they spend all the time thinking up the songs and writing them, and you cut and splice them.
Yeah, I mean, this album took me 2 years to put together, so I don't really know the track history of most of the musicians that I sample as far as how long it took them to do an album, but, typical pace is to put out an album a year, so, it takes me a long time as well to come up with these ideas. It's not just kind of taking their idea and just putting it back out there immediately.
We want to hear some of the album. It's, again, called Feed the Animals. And by the way, you have it arranged so that people can download it online and mm-hmm. pay what they want for it or download it for free, which we did. So we're wondering, do you mind that we did that?
No, it's fantastic. I think the spread of music in any way is a good thing. I've never really intended to make a living off this. I am now. It happened to come out of nowhere. But I like the music to be spread as quickly and efficiently as possible. So everyone taking it for free is fantastic.
Let's listen to track 6. It's called No Pause. So, Greg, we want you to deconstruct this for us, and we want you to pause between each artist so that we can hear the original artist. So tell us what you did.
Sure. Right there is definitely the song is by New Shoes, and it's called I Can't Wait For That, the main melody in the background. Vocals are from the Missy Elliott song Work It. Is it worth it? Let me work it. I put my thing down, flip it and reverse it. It's your primitive, it's wet yet. It's your primitive, it's wet yet. If you got a big, let me search it to find out how hard I gotta work. Yeah, it's your primitive. also hi-hat work and drum machine things there in the background that I program myself. There's a Public Enemy part definitely following it.
The rhythm, the rebel, without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme, where you never been, I'm in.
And then Heart Magic Man. It's all very linear, so kind of songs kind of come and go. And there's a lot of small elements of just, you know, percussion hits and things like that that are basically impossible to identify, but just, you know, small things to, you know, add to the production and the dynamic quality of the music.
The New York Times says that there are as many as 400 samples on the album.
It's close to that.
Well, then what do you do? I mean, how do you, when you're sleeping at night, you're thinking, oh my gosh, that Missy Elliott would work great over the new shoes.
It's not intuitive for me. I'm kind of constantly sampling little bits and pieces, isolating loops, labeling them and cataloging them, coming up with beats, cutting up things. And I kind of sit there all day long and try out different combinations. And, you know, I play live shows continuously throughout the year. So I try to introduce new small combinations of material each weekend. So yeah, just, you know, it's a slow process. And over the course of time, things kind of take shape.
Let's listen to another track from Feed the Animals. This is In Step.
Anything you want, you got it there. Anything you need, you got it there. Anything at all, you got it there.
Okay, who is that?
There's two vocals going on there. The kind of the background music is Roy Orbison, Anything You Want. And then the more hip-hop styled vocals were by an artist named Drama, and the song was called Left to Right Left. And then there was also percussion in the background that was a mixture of my own stuff and some sampled beats.
Well, and you know, you said you play live, you do a lot of this live, and that's what differentiates you. I mean, we've had other DJs who do mashups. We know people do this online, they do it in clubs. Mm-hmm. But the difference is that you sort of like have taken it into an in-your-face show. Many critics are saying that you're the first sort of superstar of this. Does that surprise you?
Definitely. I mean, I've spent so many years. I've put out basically three albums and toured for 6 years before anyone really knew my name. I was playing small clubs to, you know, 10 to 15 people a night, driving 6 hours to play in someone's basement for gas money. So to kind of see it take off to a level where it's at now is definitely crazy to me.
Greg Gillis, a sample-based producer. And by the way, you go by the name Girl Talk. Why Girl Talk?
When I started, there's a lot of people traveling the country, touring with laptops, and a lot of kind of academic, almost overly serious sort of music going on. And I was bunched in with that because I was also playing a computer. And I am a fan of a lot of that other laptop music, but I wanted to pick a name that was looked like the sore thumb on the lineup, looked like, you know, that person wasn't supposed to be playing the show, so I picked a very flamboyant name that sounds like a 10-year-old girl's band name.
Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Drop it.